Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Anna Mateo and Alice Bryant. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, as the United States prepares for Hurricane Florence, an even bigger ocean storm, Super Typhoon Mangkhut, is set to hit Southeast Asia. The storm also threatens the Philippines and Hong Kong. The super typhoon, known as Ompong in the Philippines, has winds of up to 250 kilometers per hour. That is considered a Category 5 hurricane in North America, the most severe level. More than 4 million Filipinos live in areas the storm could affect. Emergency officials say nearly 48,000 houses in high-risk areas are made of light materials and could be damaged by the powerful winds. Experts say Super Typhoon Mangkhut could cause landslides and flooding across the northern Philippine island of Luzon. The super typhoon is expected to reach the Philippines Saturday at the start of the harvest season in Luzon. The island is a major agricultural producer, and farmers are trying to save what they can of their crops. Mangkhut already has hit the U.S. island territory of Guam.
Scientists say they have discovered three new species of fish in one of the deepest places on Earth. All three species were found in the Pacific Ocean, off the coast of Chile and Peru. They were deep in the Atacama Trench, 7,500 meters below the surface. Researchers from Britain's Newcastle University say the new species have been given temporary names based on their coloring. They are known as the pink, the blue, and the purple Atacama snailfish. The three snailfish species are different from most other fish. Their unusual bodies are built to deal with the cold water and extreme pressure deep in the ocean. All three are small and translucent, meaning light can pass through their skin. They also have no scales on the skin for protection. Thomas Lindley is with Newcastle University. He said in a statement, "The hardest structures in their bodies are the bones in their inner ear, which give them balance, and their teeth. Without the extreme pressure and cold to support their bodies, they are extremely fragile and melt rapidly when brought to the surface." A team of 40 scientists from 17 nations captured video of the fish in their natural environment. Other scientists say the blue Atacama snailfish appeared to be a rare winged snailfish. But it has a long fin and a big head, similar to the ethereal snailfish off the coast of Mariana Islands. The pink was closer in appearance to the Mariana snailfish, a species found in the deepest part of the Mariana Trench, on the other side of the Pacific. The third species is a small purple snailfish. It is similar to fish living at the depth of 3,500 meters. One of the purple snailfish, about 9 centimeters long, was brought to the surface for further study. In addition to the discovery of the new species of snailfish, scientists also captured rare video of long-legged isopods, known as monopsids. The shellfish has a small body, about the size of a human hand. It can swim backwards and upside down using its extremely long legs. The scientists say what they have found in the deep sea is an environment rich with many species in large numbers. From the video shot by the Newcastle scientists, Lindley said, there is something about the snailfish that allows them to adapt to living very deep. Beyond the reach of other fish, they are free of competitors and predators. He added, they seem to be quite active and look very well fed. I'm Anna Mateo.
English can be a complex language to master. It has a lot of rules and breaks many of them. No matter your level of English, forming questions can be one of the more vexing parts of mastering the language. The good news is that we are here today to make that process easier. In a recent Everyday Grammar, we told you about subject questions, questions we ask when we want to learn the who or the which of an action. Today, we will tell you about yes or no questions. A yes or no question is a question that expects an answer of yes or no. For example,
are you coming to the show?
Has she been to Montreal?
Does this color look good on me?
As you can hear, yes or no questions do not begin with common question words such as why, where, what, how, when, and which. Instead, they often begin with the verbs do, be, or have. You already know these three verbs as among the most common in English, but they have a second separate usage as auxiliary verbs. We use auxiliary verbs with main verbs to do things like form questions and verb tenses. Auxiliary verbs are sometimes called helping verbs because they help main verbs to carry meaning. We form yes or no questions with an auxiliary verb plus subject plus main verb. Listen for that structure in the examples.
Are you coming to the show?
Has she been to Montreal?
Does this color look good on me?
Notice that the last example begins with does. When we use do, does, or did to begin a yes or no question, it shows there was no auxiliary present in its statement form. Present simple and past simple statements do not contain auxiliary verbs. For example, the statement form of the question, does this color look good on me, is this color looks good on me, and is present simple. Let's hear a few more statements and their question forms. Notice that the statements do not contain an auxiliary verb, and the questions follow the same structure, auxiliary verb plus subject plus main verb.
I went to the kitchen.
Did you go to the kitchen?
You speak English well.
Do you speak English well?
He lives in Washington, D.C.
Does he live in Washington, D.C.?
Not all yes or no questions begin with auxiliary verbs. Many begin with modal verbs. We use modal verbs to express possibility, necessity, and permission. Sometimes modal verbs are called modal auxiliaries, but for today we will simply call them modals or modal verbs. Can, could, may, might, and should are examples of modal verbs. We form these yes or no questions with a modal verb plus subject plus main verb. Listen for that structure in these examples.
Can we meet for lunch tomorrow?
Should I take her advice?
May I have your name, please?
Some yes or no questions have neither an auxiliary nor a modal. When we ask yes or no questions where the main verb is be, the structure becomes be plus subject. Let's hear how that sounds.
Is she the owner of the company?
Was he ready when you arrived?
Are you a language teacher?
At times, there is more than one auxiliary verb in a yes or no question. Or there is a modal verb plus one or more auxiliary verbs. This happens in yes or no questions with perfect tenses and with passive questions. For example, in the question, "Should I have been attending all of the meetings?" the verb tense is present perfect continuous. There is the modal should and the auxiliaries have and been. But for today, we'll stay with basic forms of yes or no questions. The goal is that you gain confidence in forming these questions, and that comes with practice. By now, you might be wondering, how do I answer a yes or no question? You can answer with a simple yes or no. But suppose you wanted to answer with something a little longer. When we answer yes or no questions, we do not usually repeat the full question. Instead, we answer with the auxiliary or modal from the question. The structure is yes or no plus subject plus auxiliary or modal. Here's what it sounds like with auxiliaries.
Did you go to the bathroom?
Yes, I did.
Has she been to Montreal?
Yes, she has.
Are you a language teacher?
Yes, I am.
And with modals.
Should I take her advice?
No, you shouldn't.
May I have your name, please?
Yes, you may.
Can we meet for lunch tomorrow?
Yes, we can.
Notice that the auxiliary or modal in each answer matches the auxiliary or modal from each question. So, do you want to practice yes or no questions now? Check out the exercises on our website and write your responses in the comments area. I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of the presidency of George W. Bush. Bush began his second term and fifth year in office in January 2005. Early in his first term, terrorists had carried out the worst attacks in United States history. President Bush declared a war on terror and led the country into wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. In his second inaugural address, he promised to continue fighting to defeat terrorism and increase democracy around the world.
So it is the policy of the United States to seek and support the growth of democratic movements and institutions in every nation and culture with the ultimate goal of ending tyranny in our world.
He also talked about his goals at home and what he called America's ideal of freedom.
In America's ideal of freedom, citizens find the dignity and security of economic independence instead of laboring on the edge of subsistence. This is the broader definition of liberty that motivated the Homestead Act, the Social Security Act, and the GI Bill of Rights. We will widen the ownership of homes and businesses, retirement savings, and health insurance, preparing our people for the challenges of life in a free society by making every citizen an agent of his or her own destiny. We will give our fellow Americans greater freedom from want and fear and make our society more prosperous and just and equal.
The United States Constitution limits presidents to two terms. Presidential historian Russell Riley at the University of Virginia's Miller Center says presidents traditionally use their first term to focus on their major goals for the country. Second terms, he says, tend to be unhappy times. During his second term, Richard Nixon resigned over the attempt to hide political wrongdoing in the Watergate case. Bill Clinton faced a trial in the Senate over his attempt to hide a relationship with a young aide. But the first major problem of George Bush's second term dropped from the sky.
You saw people on the rooftops. You saw people using claw hammers trying to break through their attic to get up onto the roof. That's why you had so many people who drowned.
In August of 2005, Susan Bennett received a phone call from her daughter, a television reporter in New Orleans, Louisiana.
She called on a Friday and said, "I think you need to come and pick up my son because there's a really big storm coming."
It was Hurricane Katrina, one of the worst natural disasters in American history. Along the Gulf of Mexico, the hardest hit states were Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. Over 1,800 people died. Property damage totaled more than $75 billion. But Katrina will be remembered mostly because of what happened in New Orleans.
It has gutted the hotel!
A day before the storm hit, officials had ordered everyone to leave the city. But thousands of people stayed. Some chose not to leave. Others were too poor, too old, or too sick to go. Then the levees broke. Those flood barriers were supposed to protect the city. Much of New Orleans was built on land that lies below sea level.
Go on, sir.
As Katrina hit, more than 80% of the city flooded. In some areas, the water was 6 meters deep. Many people who stayed were caught in the floods. Officials struggled to get food, water, and medicine to the survivors. The displaced included thousands of people who took shelter in the Superdome, a big sports arena. Out on the streets, lawless acts fed a sense of disorder and helplessness.
It's disgusting and frustrating. And we are human beings, and they're treating us like we're criminals.
We won't help.
No fuck. Susan Bennett helped create an exhibit about Hurricane Katrina at the Newseum, a museum of news in Washington.
Not only in this country, but also in newspapers across the world, you saw the same headline. It ranged from engulfed to our tsunami, chaos, and then it went to anarchy, national disgrace.
Congress later found that officials at every level of government, local, state, and federal, had failed in doing their jobs. President Bush flew over New Orleans to inspect the damage. A photograph showed him looking out the window of Air Force One at the ground below. Russell Riley at the University of Virginia says the picture expressed what many people were thinking about the handling of the disaster.
Because of the ineffectiveness of the government response at the time, that image communicated to the American people that the president was remote, that he wasn't on the ground, that the best he could do was just look out the window of a passing plane.
In 2005, a different kind of storm was hitting Iraq. American and Iraqi officials were struggling to create a democratic government. Local militias were on the rise and attacking coalition forces and other Iraqis. The violence also included Al-Qaeda suicide bombings in Iraq, which angered many Iraqis. And there was international anger as the result of photos that showed American troops abusing Iraqi prisoners. President Bush had declared the end of major combat operations on May 1st, 2003. That was less than 2 months after the invasion. But the numbers of civilian and military deaths were growing. And in the United States, surveys were showing that a growing number of Americans thought going into Iraq was a mistake.
The bad news was we were uncomfortable with it, and we wanted to get out, and we could not understand how things could go so terribly wrong.
Judith Yaffe joined the National Defense University after 20 years as a Middle East expert at the Central Intelligence Agency.
That's where the lack of strategy and the mismanagement come in. But I think it's also true that, you know, Americans just wanted to say, why are we in Iraq? Why are we in any of these places? Because historically speaking, it's not a role we've been comfortable with.
She says by President Bush's second term, few Iraqis wanted to cooperate with the Americans to make the country more secure. But President Bush said American troops could not leave until Iraqi forces replaced them. In 2006, an Iraqi court sentenced the country's former leader to death. Saddam Hussein was hanged for crimes against humanity. But nothing else seemed to change. Violence and insurgent attacks continued. Iraq seemed to be on the edge of being torn apart by civil war. Early the next year, President Bush announced that he was sending more troops to Iraq. He thought it would help stop the violence.
These troops will work alongside Iraqi units and be embedded in their formations. Our troops will have a well-defined mission to help Iraqis clear and secure neighborhoods, to help them protect the local population, and to help ensure that the Iraqi forces left behind are capable of providing the security that Baghdad needs.
The temporary increase of about 30,000 troops came to be called the surge. In September of 2007, the top commander in Iraq reported to Congress that the violence was decreasing. The surge may have helped create the conditions for this change, but there were other reasons as well. Middle East expert Judith Yaffe says many Iraqis decided to work with the Americans to defeat the insurgency.
The real truth is, and it's a good news story, that the Iraqis themselves saw that this was a greater danger to them, that there was nothing to be gained. The Sunnis of Iraq in particular saw that Al-Qaeda was hurting them, that it was a danger to them, that there was much more to be gained by aligning with the U.S. forces.
By the time President Bush was finishing his second term, Iraqi and American officials had agreed on a withdrawal date to end the war. The last American forces would leave Iraq by the end of 2011. Russell Riley at the University of Virginia says it is too soon to know how history will judge the United States' actions in Iraq.
If Iraq proves to be a policy success, then the surge will be a critical turning point and a terrific exercise of presidential leadership.
He also points out that the war is not the only measure by which the 43rd president will be judged. Professor Riley put it this way: the great debate among historians will not be whether Bush was a powerful president or a consequential president, but whether he directed those powers in the most fruitful way that he could have. So what else was going on in the United States during this period? Millions of people were voting for which singer should get a recording contract on American Idol. Year after year, it was the most popular show on television.
Oh, Robert, I think you just killed my favorite song of all time.
Killed in a good way or a bad way?
I'm afraid. Well, listen, killing is never good.
Killing is never good.
There's never a happy killing.
I'm sorry to hear that.
No, I mean, that was first degree on that one.
I need some shelter, my own protection, baby.
But the biggest story in music was not what people were listening to, but how. Sales of CDs in stores fell as more and more people downloaded songs from the internet. On iTunes, Fergie's Big Girls Don't Cry was the most downloaded song of 2007.
And big girls don't cry.
For the first half of the decade, there seemed to be nothing to cry about in the American housing market. Home prices were going up and up, which made sellers happy. And lenders were offering bigger and bigger loans at easy terms and low interest rates, which made buyers happy. The government supported the easing of lending rules as a form of social policy, a way to help more people buy homes. Rates of home ownership, a part of the American dream, reached record highs. In 2005, nearly 7 out of 10 Americans owned their own home. But many home buyers had been given mortgage loans that they could not afford to pay back. And that was not the only problem. Banks had been selling those loans as securities to investors around the world. Everyone thought they were getting a good deal. The banks, the borrowers, the investors. But then the price bubble burst and the housing market collapsed. Many borrowers lost their homes because they were unable to make their monthly loan payments. That was the situation Karen Lucas and her husband of Cleveland, Ohio, found themselves in.
I've done my crying. I've made my peace, and I've put it in God's hands.
As home values fell, many people found themselves underwater, meaning they owed more on their mortgage than their house was worth. Suddenly, there was a lot to cry about. By the end of 2007, the economy was sliding into the Great Recession.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.